Hi, you're listening to Chicago Magazine's Chefs on the Grill.
Four, three, two.
One more time.
Hi, I'm Meg Nagrant, and welcome back to another edition of Chefs on the Grill. Chefs on the Grill is a collaboration between Chicago Magazine and Hungry Magazine. You can find an archive of all our interviews at www.chicagomag.com or at www.hungrymag.com. This month I sit down with Steve Cipetti. If that name sounds familiar, it might be because he's part of the Cipetti Veal and Lamb family, one of the only surviving meat packers from the storied Chicago stockyards. In the mid-90s, when Chicago was still considered a meat and potatoes town, Cipetti shook those roots by opening Mango, a new American bistro, which served up dishes like Moroccan barbecue sauce and vanilla bean sweetbreads. Cipetti also went on to open Grapes and Rhapsody, and in December of 1999, at the height of his success, he closed down Mango and Grapes and took a break from the industry. In 2003, he came back by helping to open Café Le Coq in Oak Park, and now he's returning to Chicago with Viand, another new American bistro, a reimagining of Mango in 2006.
I'm glad that you're here because, you know, as a food writer, there's, you eat a lot of meals and you eat a lot of meals out, and there's hundreds of thousands of courses over time, and there's very few that you remember. But there is one I remember, which is at Café Le Coq. You had sweetbreads with maple vanilla sauce, I think it was. You know, that's like one of my top five dishes of all time. It was one that ended up in like one of my year-end roundups.
And, really?
Yeah, I love that dish. It's simple, but it was like such a great, great flavor. You know, most people go savory with their sweetbreads most of the time.
I did that. That was actually a dish I'd done since I had Mango. That was a great innovation, because at that time I was really switching my cuisine styles and going more Asian, and that's where it was a combination of doing a French Asian. So we did a sweet sauce, the vanilla sauce, which goes classically with the sweetbread and had that flavor, but I brought it in a Moroccan type barbecue, and actually it was like a molasses reduction.
Okay.
And did an offset it a little bit, so we had a little bit of zing to it. So that was a fun, I like that dish a lot too. It's one of my, a lot of people request that dish.
Yeah, it was one I talk about all the time.
Well, you'll see it here.
We will.
You will see it here,
That's great. Definitely. Well, I was just looking at this menu here that you have, and I saw forbidden foie gras on there. What's that about?
Well, it's forbidden, isn't it?
It is forbidden.
Yeah,
so it's the real deal. Is that?
Yeah, why not? I to me, food is food, and I enjoy food all around my life, and coming to live in Europe and seeing things like that. I mean, I think that some of this has become so silly and outrageous. It's taken out of context, mm-hmm. And I think what matters is that you have good food. We're not really doing anything wrong. And we're not raising it to the point where I think anything. You look at the way other animals are being fed. Look at the chicken industry. Look at other industries, and stop picking on that one. Look at other ones, because there's a lot more problems.
Mm-hmm. Are you worried at all about the repercussions of, like, are they enforcing it?
I don't know. Yeah. I know on the south side of Chicago, there was a lot of restaurants that just put it on their menu and said, I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a rebellion as far as, you know, certain chefs go, and said, hey, you know what? It's what it is. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, whatever it is. I think that, you know, it's so funny because the industry was actually hurting. The foie gras industry was really tanking. It was really not doing well. And this, all it did was resurgence and made more popularity. Certain companies went bankrupt three times. They couldn't survive. They couldn't produce the foie gras. It was just becoming too costly to do it. And the demand was getting less and less because fine dining market is shrinking down.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden you say, okay, let's forbid it. And then all of a sudden it's been this outrage of customers going, do you have it? I want it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been more demand now than prior.
But
it's what a great way. I love it.
Yeah, they had an unintended consequence, which is funny. You think about all the foods out there. It's like Alderman might be doing a service if they try to ban seasonal vegetables.
Right?
People might start, you know, hey, I'm going to go to the Green City Market.
Exactly. Yeah,
You were one of the first guys doing new American cuisine, or American cuisine, if you want to call it that, with Mango. I mean, you know, I was thinking back about it. I didn't live in Chicago back in 95, 96 when you were opening up Mango, but I'm very aware of it. And, you know, you were, in some ways, that was still back when Chicago was still a meat and potatoes town. How much, where did that come from for you, approaching new American cuisine at that point? I mean, obviously a lot of the roots come from Chez Panisse and what Alice Waters used to do, but nobody was really doing that kind of food necessarily in Chicago when you came in.
My background, my mother's mother's from Alsace, France. And my father's father came from Calabrese, Italy, town of Corsans. So, you know, there was a strong Italian-French background in my house. We come from, my mother is from four generations of butchers on her side.
Sure. My Veal.
That's not, no. My mother's Carol.
Carol,
K-A-R-O-W. And he was the first, he was a meat packer in the city of Chicago. He was the first one to have the first refrigerated meat truck in the city of Chicago. So there's a little history behind him. And then my father's side, he comes from four generations as well of butchers. And his father had Chepetti lamb and veal. So that's how that started with his brothers, Mike, Alex, Sam, and my father, Art. And they started Chepetti lamb and veal. And so there's two very strong butchers, food, very strong in our family. Food was always a presence, a big thing in our family growing up. But there's Italian and French. And I like my cooking even to this day has a very strong background in those, but I'm American. And I need to have those influences. I'm American. I need to take the classic structure of those things and bring it to American, how I can present it in American style. At that time, you know, chefs for me, like Jean-Georges Van Richten was just coming up with, you know, at that time, Jojo in New York. And you had Joachim Spaceman from Patina out in California. And he was just moving to California at the time, but I knew him and Wolfgang Puck. And I wanted to go in that direction because even these people were very classically European chefs started saying, I'm American, and I'm proud of it. And I believe that too. I mean, I'm American. I'm born and raised here. I'm not French. I'm not Italian. I'm American, and I wanted to go into that route because I think that's the dining clientele that I have. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not in France. I'm not cooking for French people. I'm cooking for a melting pot of culture who appreciates variety when they go out to be able to see the different variety of products and see that stuff.
Was there pressure at all to go into the veal and lamb business since it's such a part of your family?
There was enough relatives, I think, that was running the business and doing it all that I think that was a great business, but I needed something that I thought was a little bit more sexy, a little bit more fun, a little bit more appealing than that part of the industry.
Did you grow up learning to butcher?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. By the time you were hitting culinary school, you already had a...
The crazy part about it was my mother... Again, and she went to French cooking school in Chicago, Antoinette Pope cooking school. And, so we were having very, elegant dinners when we were kids. And it wasn't like she was preparing for a restaurant, but she just did classic French food. We'd have, ossobuco or, pig's feet or, just crazy dishes. Mm-hmm. Really elaborate. But it was all other end cuts because my father would bring this stuff home. We always had, the celebratory, here's a prime rib for my grandfather or here's, a rack of lamb for my father. Not every day, though. We would use the other cuts of meat that didn't sell, at my grandfather's or something, and they would bring that home. And that was where I became used to other cuts of meat to, cook with them.
Sure.
And get used to those tastes, like sweetbreads. Sure. Sweetbreads, brains. I mean, it was crazy, but you're, sitting there eating it, but my mother would come up with dishes because those are the things. You'd have the prime cuts you'd sell.
Right.
These you didn't sell.
Sure, everybody wants the chops.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Right.
So my mother was always bringing home the exotic and cooking with the exotic, and I think that opened my mind, at least when I got older, to be more receptive to that.
Yeah.
But I was, I always wanted to be in the restaurant business even from a kid. And I was mostly interested in fast food, the whole McDonald's concept and everything wow, hamburgers. And I wasn't really thinking gourmet at the time. I really wasn't. I was thinking about how coming from the south side of Chicago, something that was more approachable because that was the kind of restaurants we had down there. We didn't see fine dining. The cottage was, down there, but there was really nothing that fine dining.
Mm-hmm.
So I was really going into a more fast food type market. Mm-hmm. My first job was at McDonald's.
I know, you were one of the early students at Kendall, so I think there was even some debate as to whether you were the first or...
I don't know, it came up as, I had my student ID number one, and it was just because I was the first one there.
That's kind of funny.
And it was weird. And it was a weird kind of situation. Yeah.
Was Sean McClain there at that time?
No, he came right after. He came I think 3-4 years after I was on.
I was curious if it'd been funny if you guys were both in that
first class with me was Jack Jones.
Okay. Yeah, Jack's bistro.
Exactly.
He used to bistro Marbizet and Atlantique and then all. Absolutely.
And Mike Altenberg.
Oh. Yeah.
Over at Campanella. Yeah. And also, there was a lot of great people that were in that class.
It's interesting, though, because, that was when it was starting, and now Kendall's this huge behemoth. They've got this big campus.
Huge.
students are forking over like $30,000 a year to go there. And I'm curious what you think about that industry. I mean, it seems like so, I'm curious about chefs today. You know, it seems like so many people are driven by Food Network and these, you know, they read these books and the newspapers and they think, hey, I'm going to be a celebrity chef or, you know, it seems scary, you know.
You know, first of all, this is not rocket science. It's a passion of life. It's a way of life. And I think the way that this, you know, if you want to talk about the celebrity chefs, and you look at somebody like Emeril Lagasse or look at somebody like Whiffing Puck, you don't look at them because they're like celebrity because they're doing something special or unique. You look at them because they love their life so much and there's so much passion about what they do that it translates and it's an expression of life. And you're like, I want that lifestyle. I want to be like that. I want to care so much about what I do that it shows. And it shows them the way they talk, the way they eat, the way they present themselves. That's the way I feel that I am. I feel like, you know, food is part of my life. I think, I breathe, I eat food all day long. And it's crazy to think that way, but I do. And that's my enjoyment. You know, it's like what they say when you're off or when you work. I don't know the difference between being off and work. It's all the same to me. It's just, this is what I do. This is what I don't know what I would do if I wasn't doing this.
Yeah, I think the greatest thing you can do in life is blur the distinctions between life and work.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think it's really sad when somebody has to just go to work and not really care about what they do or not have fun with it.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how you even function. But Kendall and the culinary schools out there, I think, are Kendall's a great culinary school. I support it. I think what they're doing is they've got a big vision. I think students, they have to come to reality why they're going there. And again, is it just because they want this idolized kind of lifestyle? Or is it because they really want to have a passion of life, a way of life, like they need direction in life, and this is something they feel inside of them? And then there's other people that want to go to the schools because they say, well, that looks like an interesting thing, and they try it out. I think the school is great only in the sense that it brings you such a variety of product and in such an intense, small period of time. Because if you work in the industry, sometimes you won't be able to touch all those products in that short of time. It takes years to get to that point. And if these kids go to school, no matter what they pay, I still say go out and work for almost nothing for another year. Because honestly, it's the only way you'll grow and learn.
Speaking of which, one of your early mentors was Paul Bartolotta.
Yeah.
When he was at Spiaggia. And, you know, Bartolotta worked with some pretty heady people in France himself, and Bocuse, yeah, and some of those guys.
Yeah.
What did you learn from that experience? What did you take from that? What were those days like?
With Bartolotta?
Yeah.
He is an intense individual. And again, here is another person. Put him in the same league as Wolfgang Puck. Put him in the same league as, you know, Alice Waters or any of them. He is somebody who he loves his food. Food is part of the way of his life, and it shows. Everything that Paul does is so meticulous and so refined, and it shows he follows through with such detail and finesse in what he does. I think it really shows in the quality of food that he presents.
Mm-hmm.
And it's consistent. Talk about a man who's very consistent in the product that he presents to the public. It's an amazing thing, and I think Paul is a very driven individual, and I think he does very well at what he does.
The other flip side of the coin, of course, is since you've been doing this for a while, you've been a mentor in some ways to some folks. And the one that comes to mind for me is I spent some time with Ryan Polley.
Yeah.
And I know one of his first jobs was in your kitchen at Mango. And I wonder what it's like to see the other side of the coin, to see some of these guys that worked for you or that you worked with, you know, now Esquire Best Restaurant last year and things like that. How do you feel about that?
You know, I think it's great. I think, you know, it's like my chef told me. My chef was, my true mentor was Fernand Gutierrez, and he was at the Ritz-Carlton, and he was a very famous chef in the city of Chicago, who recently just passed away. But he was my mentor, and he gave me the guidance, and his thing was always about teaching other people. He mentored me, he mentored Sarah Stegner up at Prairie Grass, George Mambaros up there, Pascal Vignol out at his restaurant out in California, Susan Weaver, who's now running all the Cafe Barbaribas, Carrie over at Naha.
Mm-hmm.
We all worked. Reto, I mean, we can literally go through all Ron, you can go through all the people that worked for him, and he mentored him, and it was always about, like, well, beat me. You know, cooking is an evolution from Escoffier's day till today. Every day we take from what we learned from before, pass on the knowledge, take it, redefine it, and keep introducing it. And the trick to really being successful is not you doing it, because the reality is you can't touch every single dish that leaves your kitchen. But the fact is, if you can teach other people to do it and have them succeed, that's real success. And I feel that I've passed on that legacy as far as, you know, not just with Ryan, but, you know, Christine Savito over at Wave, and Ryan Poley, and Todd Davies, and there's a lot of people that work for me that are very successful in this industry, has really made a dent. And of course, you know, I look for them and I say, go ahead, do better than me, excel. And I think it's great. It shows that these guys are just as much dedicated, and they picked up that passion of life and that way of life, and hopefully they keep going down that same path. I want to see them do really well.
So after Mangos, you had Grapes, you were Rhapsody, you were Mosan.
We had five restaurants at one time, yeah.
Yeah, and then 2000, 2003 was kind of a downtime for you. I mean, I don't know that it was downtime.
2000, in December 31st, 2000, December 1999, we closed Mango and Grapes. We were done. We sold the building to a developer. We owned the building. We sold the building to a developer. We decided that we were going to let the restaurant close up. And the partnership was ending because there was an opportunity. And we just decided to part ways. So my partners and I separated, shook our hands and separated. And honestly, I needed some time to you know, figure out my life. After 5 years of, you know, pushing very hard and dedicating it, we had five restaurants, we had the cooking school, we had so much going on. It took a lot out of me. And I needed time to, you know, come back. And I wanted to offer something to the city of Chicago's market. At that time, before, in 1985, I was the only, really one of the first, next to Scott Harris. You know, you're talking about a chef-driven concept where it was, you know, besides before that was the Jackie Chan and everybody else. But, you know, then you got into, then there was a period there was nobody during the early 90s. And then, like, 95, you know, you had, you know, Le Bouchon was Jean-Claude Pouvet, and you had Mia Francesca. And then we came along, you know. And the market, there was a need for it in the market. And people wanted that simplicity, the freshness, the, you know, a humble approach to dining, that they felt that it was all comfort food, the exoticness that was in there. So it really met the niche at the time. By the time 2000 came, 56 chef-driven restaurants opened up in the year 1999, from everybody from John Hogan to Susie Crofton. So, I mean, what was a unique concept back in 1995 was multiplied by how many, you know, Didier Durand. You look at all these guys, and that opened up after that, small, private, little restaurants, entrepreneurial restaurants downtown. And to turn around in 2000, to turn around and say, okay, let's go do the Mango again, it didn't make much sense. 5 years, it had its shelf life, it needed to be reinvented, it needed to go away, it needed to come up with something. At the time, I couldn't offer something new. So I thought it was better than reopening Mango right away. It'd be better time to sit back, think about what I was doing, think about what was needed in the market, and figure on that.
What were the highlights from those years, time off? You know, what did that teach you? What did you reflect on?
Oh, I started doing photography. I started getting into other forms of art and style. So I started doing photography.
Yeah, I know you had an exhibit.
Yeah, Gallery 500 in Chicago, and as well as in New York. And we were at some libraries all around, and we started doing that. So it's a pretty successful, it's called Edible Art. And it was just photography that I went into people's kitchens. Some were my own and some other kitchens. And we took pictures and tried to change them around. And it was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun doing that.
You still do a lot of photography? Is that a hobby? Or a
I just finished up a cookbook. I did the photography and food development for a doctor, Dr. Rosshauser, out in Oak Park. He has something called Prolotherapy. And Miriam and Rosshauser are two wonderful doctors, nutritionists, and they do alternative ways of curing through food and diet to change your lifestyle to make you a better and healthier person. So we just spent a year and a half doing a conceptual piece, and it was a really interesting approach. You know, it's so funny, here I am cooking with butter and cream and all these rich, extravagant ingredients, and you're thinking, oh my God, this is unhealthy, and the doctor's saying, no, it's not.
Huh.
Certain bodies can handle that, certain body types, certain body blood can handle this, and others can't.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really fascinating to get involved with this person and come up with different dishes that would actually maybe help people in their lives and control their weight and all this stuff. So it's been an exciting process. We took a year and a half to conceptualize each piece of the food, going on these different diets and doing the photography of it. And we just finished up.
Nice.
So hopefully, maybe, I think it might be out this fall or beginning of the year.
What's the name of that book? Can I mean?
It'll be The Hauser Lifestyle.
Okay.
And it's it was a really exciting project, you know, to do something like that.
Was photography a new thing for you back in 2000? Like
just picked it up.
Picked it up.
I paint and I draw and I do a lot of artwork, and I've always had that since I was a kid, so I've always done that. I guess that reflects in some of the artistic presentations that maybe I do, but photography was just like another way of capsizing on that. So that was great.
What kind of stuff do you paint?
I do a lot of oil work. Mostly, again, now it's all food-based. So it's kind of unique to go back.
Never get away.
No. And every once in a while, you'll see me with the color pencils. And I used to, at Mango,
most of the artwork that was hanging on the walls was mine.
Oh.
All the artwork at Grapes was all mine. Huh. I painted at the restaurants. And it was just a way of, again, I wanted people to realize the way of expression. The restaurants were just the concept. It was like who I was, how I learned how to cook, where I wanted to be. Mango was a way of where I started how to cook. This is where I wanted to be, American chef. This was the kind of food I wanted it to be, the artistic presentation. That was really a capsized what Steve Schiappetti was about.
Mm-hmm. You know, nowadays it's kind of people approach the plate as like a painting, but do you think that that changed the way, or that was it influenced the way you approached the plate? I mean, how do you approach plate today? You know, is it still very artistically? Is it a deconstruction? I'm curious how you think about it as an artist.
I start every dish by what do I want to eat? I cook for myself first. But when I conceptualize a dish, it breaks down the elements of taste. Mm-hmm. And if it's sour, balance and harmony, over almost a Japanese approach to food, where you have to have the balance. If it's, you know, if it's too sweet, add vinegar. If it's too much vinegar, and add, you know, sugar to it. So it's always a balance and harmony when I create a dish. Like going back to the sweetbreads that you love so much, it was, again, it was the creaminess, the richness of the vanilla, but then you needed something to cut through it. Mm-hmm. And the molasses, that sugar, really did it. So, you know, it was that, it's that yin-yang, it's that pulling away, coming back, and that's how I do it. It's mm-hmm. it's breaking down the elements of the actual component of taste. And when I work with my cooks, I always try to go with palate memory. That's like one of my biggest techniques we try to use with the cooks, is to develop a palate memory to be able to say, recall, and say, here, taste this. If I say asparagus, have asparagus come to your mouth right now. Then you say tomato. Now taste tomato in your mouth. Can you taste tomato with asparagus in your mouth? Now let's add hollandaise to that. Can you taste a hollandaise sauce? Now you can kind of see the components as they come in, and you want to almost taste the dish in your mouth before, like an artist, you have to conceptualize where you're going with this. You don't go to the dish and just like, here, throw it together. You've got to know the end-all product, or where you wanted to be with this. Sometimes you surprise yourself. Sometimes it's different than what you taste.
Sure, it's like they say, like Beethoven writes a symphony when he's deaf, and or, you know, Mozart, you know, it's because he knows the notes,
right?
And so this is a way of knowing flavor notes, you know, and you can compose the dish in your head, and you know, and you know how it's going to taste on the plate.
You try.
How do you teach yourself that sense memory of taste? You know, is it just about consciousness when you eat? Because I would guess a lot of people just shove stuff in their mouth and they don't think about it.
Absolutely. And it is going through having the cooks taste every single thing. I mean, you have to eat the food you make. I tell them, we have to cook for ourselves first. We think we always want to cook for the customer. Mm-hmm. But the customer doesn't come, we don't know the customer, so we don't know what their tastes are. We need to cook for ourselves, and hopefully the customers appreciate what we do.
Mm-hmm. I think that's interesting, because I think I remember reading something about Thomas Keller talking about how every chef has the ideal diner that they cook for. And I think for him, it was like his, I can't remember exactly,
mom
I think it was. And it's interesting to hear you say that it's you, you know, and I'm sure everybody's got somebody different, and that's, you know, it's just interesting, because that's the challenge of cooking, is that there isn't a universal palate. And so, you know, it tastes good to you, you know, like for me, I know my ideal diner is my wife, like I'm always cooking for her, you know, but the funny thing about that is, over the years, I know she doesn't like cilantro, so, you know, that doesn't make it in, as much as I love it.
Exactly.
It's funny, it's always a challenge, is how do you do that, you know, and I guess you have to satisfy yourself for that diner first, and then...
Well, I mean, there's 17,000 restaurants in the city of Chicago, I mean, my God, it's like in Europe, I mean... You know, when you go to Europe and you have ratatouille, you know, or like you have a beef bourguignon. I mean, this is a classic French dish. You can go anywhere across France and find beef bourguignon, right? Well, why would you go to one bistro opposed to the other? You don't go to one bistro expecting the beef bourguignon to be the exact same beef bourguignon somewhere else. It has the same elements, but the taste is uniquely different. That's the difference in cuisine. And the same thing with the city of Chicago. I hope that, you know, somebody likes my steak the way I do it. It's because the way I do it. And somebody's going to go to somebody else to go there because they like the way that happens. You can't make, if I did the same dish as every other restaurant, what would make us unique? Well, we'd all be the same name, the same chef, the same recipe book. And I think consumers, sometimes you have consumers that appreciate the difference and some people that don't appreciate it. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people do come into restaurants with that kind of knowledgeable perception of saying, you know, I've had the steak this way and that's the way it should be done. That you had it that way and you loved it at that restaurant, go back to that restaurant. Mm-hmm. Come to my restaurant, have it a different way.
I think I read about you had you and your wife had a fudge company, and then I think Banana Bakery. What's the deal with those concepts? Is that still going on? Is your wife kind of doing that? Is that her thing?
No, I'm involved with her. We just opened up Banana Bakery this year. It's we had a fudge company. We were selling fudges online, and there's four different flavors: Bananarama, Joe Monkey, Nutty Putty, and anyways, we created the chocolate company. We were doing chocolate for our neighbors and parties, and we were doing a lot of catering off to the side during the years. And people would come to me, and they would really appreciate it. We did a lot of homemade chocolates. I've always done candies in all my restaurants. We make homemade truffles. We were always into the candy business in some way, shape, or form. The fudge came around because we found a great chocolate company in France that we can partner with, produce this fudge at a very reasonable rate. We're using European chocolate, very high quality, 64% cocoa powder, cocoa beans. So this is a very high, rich, bitter chocolate, very good, full of antioxidants, very healthy for you if chocolate is. So there's a really a lot of positives to this chocolate. And we wanted to create something that was more American. So we, instead of creating the classic chocolate truffle and doing the, you know, the little candies, we went with something that real American, which I think fudge is. And we brought a European quality chocolate to fudge. And when I made it, it was hysterical because I went with this French manufacturer and I said, I'm making fudge. And he looked at me and his jaw dropped and he was like, what? What are you doing? And he's like, are you insane? And I'm like, no, because I said, you know, I like fudge. The American people like the fudge. It's a very approachable product. People have a fantasy and a familiarity to it. So it's a really great thing to produce. And I have a great product to back it up with. So it was doing very well. And then we were looking for a space for a long time. And we found it. We found something in Westchester. It was a neighborhood very out in the western suburbs that lent itself to the neighborhood. So we moved into there, and we do other baked goods now. We do fresh homemade donuts every day. Our donut machine, you know, we have the kicking out 1,200 donuts an hour. So it's pretty fun, and it's approachable. We want to do something for the kids because now I have two children, and we wanted to have something fun with the kids to participate with. And we were doing. I just finished up. Writing a book for my family, a family cookbook for people as well, that we'll start doing photo photography for this next year and try to get that for next year to be on the shelves. But it's a family cookbook. It's not about, coming to my restaurant and try to be, mango or something. It's about trying to do home food for real recipes.
This is what you cook at home.
Yeah, this is mostly, actually, more than half the recipes will come from my mom. So I was really proud to have that and do that.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, those are the best. I think one of my best friends, his in-laws gave their daughter a cookbook. They had like six friends, and all eight of them came together and wrote like the 70-page cookbook when they all left Cincinnati to go to school.
That's cool.
And it's funny because I cook out of it all the time because there's
cool.
These great
cool.
Cincinnati chili and these regional things, but that were their specific. And I love them. And I just made some the other day, and it's like, there's sort of that connection of the generations and the love and what that meant in that home. And I just love it. I think that's a great concept. I'm surprised more chefs don't do that,
I think a lot of the time it's about getting your art. You know, a lot of times chefs go for the thing, I want to get my art, everybody to read it, and everybody put me on a platform and say, look at what I'm doing.
What's one of the iconic recipes that would be in this book that, you know, for you is like your childhood or your life? It's the recipe that's always the return to that you make for your kids. Is there something in there?
Crazy as it sounds, it's lamb. It's braised lamb shank.
Of course.
I mean, it's just crazy that this is, my mother made it since I was a kid. We hated lamb. A lot of us hated it because we ate so much. A lot of us were like, lamb again? And it was like, but she would always find recipes that were so unique with lamb. That would be like, oh my God, this is so good. And you would never even know other lamb. And we feature that in even this restaurant. We do a braised lamb shank, and it's one of those things. It's literally, you can make it very easy, but it's one of those things I will pass on.
How do you approach it? Is it a typical, like, a red wine kind of braised?
No,
or?
Absolutely not. It's a Moroccan lamb shank.
Okay.
And it's a very unique, it's a sweet, and it's got a lot of dry fruit and everything in it, so it's a really unique dish, so.
Well, let's talk about this place. Let's talk about Beyond, your new thing. You know, this is a space that has been here for a little bit. And, you know, what's your vision for it? I mean, what are you thinking about doing with this?
Well, after, again, I left 5 years ago, really not being part of the downtown scene because I thought there was really no opportunity. And really, like Mango, There was no reason to do mango. There was no reason to do that. I feel like I'm going to return back to doing mango, and because now I think conceptually, and it's a concept that really fits today's times. Economically, you know, there's some challenging things going on, and I think that we're going to make an affordable restaurant, bistro, somewhere place where people feel comfortable to come once every 2 weeks, and you know, this is like, hey, let's go to the weekly joint and find the menu that's constantly revolving, constantly changing for them, have the uniqueness. With the menu. It's not just going to be one. It's an American menu, so it's going to be broad-based. The restaurant has a definite bistro feel to it, so we have an American bistro type of concept to it.
I think I read that you are thinking about approaching more tableside presentation, or what some people would call a la russe.
You know, I think that, you know, entertainment and dining, I think a lot of restaurants have gotten away from the fact of why do people go out for dinner. And you go to dinner for, you know, good food, good service, good atmosphere. And that's one of the reasons I always loved Richard Melman's restaurants in the city in a lot of ways, because he always had entertainment in the dining room. I think that that's one thing I hopefully will be able to introduce here again, is to bring some of that entertainment back into the dining room. Some with tableside, you know, whether it be making guacamole tableside or making, you know, doing crepes tableside or doing something. I like to have the, you know, the experience where people feel like they're part of the food, that there's an interaction going on, especially with today's technology and what's available to me. Interaction, personalization of the food for the guest is now the new future. So we need to readjust. And
why do you think people went away from that? I mean, it was such a, you know, like I long for like a tableside Caesar, you know, or like some, you know, it's like these were like the hallmarks of the great restaurants, like 21 Club in New York, and you know, it's just like anywhere, you know, and it's, you know, maybe it was it economics and logistics.
It's economics as far as the staff. I mean, it comes about time turning tables, you know. I'm not interested in, you know, I want people to have an intimate, romantic dining experience in a bistro. I think that's why they come out. They're spending their hard-earned money, and I'm so appreciative that somebody chooses me over the 17,000 other restaurants in the city. I thank every customer that comes in here because I think it's really important that we do. I mean, it's a, you know, I appreciate every, you know, customer that comes, visits me, and chooses me out. And I think that you should give them something for their, you know, have an experience that's worth their time and effort.
Are there some specific dishes on the new menu that, or things that you're thinking about that you're really excited about that you're bringing out for people?
You know, a lot of, like, again, what I've done is reinvented some of the dishes from Mango. I mean, I took back and I went back to the sweetbread dish, which is one of those classics, the lamb shank dish, which is, again, another classic, the shrimp, potato wrap shrimp, which is always a big one, the big favorite. We're bringing a lot of those dishes back. We kind of tweaked them a little bit to make more modern times. Mm-hmm. But I'm very excited. The junk food cart. And you'll be very surprised about the presentations and things like how it comes out. Junk food cart is like one of the signature dishes at Mango. It's an actual grocery cart filled with homemade Oreo cookies and root beer floats and brownies. And you get a big cart full of all this junk food. So that's what I want. I always want people to come here not to... I feel that somebody orders something, they read it one way on a menu, but when they get it, it's a little bit more than what they expect. I want people to feel like this is an entertainment. It's like, well, I didn't expect that.
You know, you're doing breakfast, lunch, and dinner, so there's a lot more going on in that sense. You know, I just think about the logistics of you know, that quality. And I mean, I'm sure you'd be able to do it, but it just it seems
breakfast, like... I love breakfast.
Yeah.
That was one of the, I mean, that wasn't even an issue about me opening for breakfast because I see a decline in the downtown. Going back, turn the clock back 15, 20 years ago, and when I was in this, I used to love going to the corner neighborhood joints, you know, Tempo, whatever, and going and having my breakfast every morning before I started. Nobody's doing it. It's like less and less places around here, and it's almost become like bye-bye. What happened? I don't understand that. And breakfast, my conceptualization for my future has always been that I want to open my own hotel. Mm-hmm. And because I think there's no better way of showing somebody my lifestyle than encapsulating them from the day, the minute they wake up to the moment they go to sleep to have Steve Schipetti's food. Mm-hmm. That is like the best thing I could ever do.
Yeah, it reminds me of like Fernand Pont.
Yeah, exactly.
It, you know, it was an inn and a restaurant. I hear Keller is actually thinking about doing that with the French Laundry now.
It's about capturing somebody's attention. And not just showing them, it's not just the dinner thing. It's everything. It is from breakfast, it's lunch, it's dinner. We open up at 6, we close at 10. There's no overnight, there's no... But we are open as a restaurant should be. And we're trying to bring things to the public that maybe they didn't see, maybe make it some more fun. We're changing the breakfast items to some different items that maybe you didn't see. But I think it's very important. I think it's very important to have that as a restaurant an option.
Last two questions, I always ask these. So the first one is, last meal, you know, it's the quintessential chef question. What would you eat?
You know, it's a very good question. My favorite still to this day is just a simple prime rib.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a big prime rib freak. I like it because it's a good cut. It's exactly what it should be. It's got fat. It's got flavor. It's rich. It's decadent. Give me that with a nice béarnaise sauce and, pack on some more fat and give me a double baked potato and I'm there. I'm a simple guy when it comes to that, you know. I'm not, some of the best meals are the simple meals. Like a roasted chicken is great, but definitely prime rib if I were to say my last meal, that would be definitely something.
Say you're throwing a dinner party. Anybody, alive or dead, can be there. Who do you want to be there? You know, maybe why? You know, what would you ask them? What would you talk to them about?
I think certain people I think that are really unique. Dead-wise, I would have to say definitely Fernand Poit or definitely, James Beard. You know, two guys that, again, lived their life. It was all about them. It was all about the food. It was all about everything. Their whole career dictated that. That would just be something to me that would be, like, very important to have that kind of connection. Still my chef, unfortunately, Fernand Gutierrez just passed on. And, I was very fortunate for him to fly up from Mexico where he was doing the, and be at the restaurant from opening of Mango. He was at pretty much opening of every one of my restaurants. And it's a shame he won't be here for this one, but definitely he would be something somebody I always like to cook for. There's people, whether they're famous or not, doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Famous people sometimes appreciate food and sometimes they're done. When I was at the Ritz, we've catered to everybody from presidents to ambassadors to movie stars. And sometimes people, regardless of their status and how much money and everything, if they like good food, then I want them to come to my table. If they don't care about food and it's just a way of life, then, it's not somebody I want.
Was there an interesting anecdote or remarkable meal from that time in the hotel? Like somebody that you guys met?
Oh, name it. Name a time. I mean, it was the weirdest one was when Tom Hanks came in and I had to make 5 pounds of smoked turkey every day for his dog who was doing Turner and Hooch.
Uh-huh.
His dog was, and I had to cook 5 pounds of turkey every day for the dog. How impressive. Yeah, for Hooch. It's like, every day I had to make the turkey for the dog. Okay. Is that really brave? There's no humility other than that. And I'm like, is the dog complaining? If you really want to put grips on reality, that's it, And I think that's very important in our industry. We have to keep a humility to it because it is just food. I mean, let's get real. Because I've had great hamburgers and it's one of my favorite dishes I still eat today. My favorite place is down at Top Notch, down on the south side of Chicago. The guy is 70 years old, every day, behind the counter, grinds his own meat, does everything. It's one of the best burgers you'll find in the city of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
I love street food. I mean, if I were out to, people say, what's your favorite food? Always it's street food. It's going to the streets and finding things that you find in different neighborhoods, going to San Francisco, whether you get the big bowl of bread, the clam chowder or whatever in the sourdough bowl, going to New York and even get the steak sandwich on the streets of Philly or whatever. I like street food. I'm like one of those guys that likes to go and just grab a hot dog or something that's really just made by somebody that's just doing it.
Is there a good street food, something quintessential from Chicago that you can think of that you've had or that you love?
I still go down, I agree with Rick, where we go down to the market and you go down to where there's the Mexican stands.
Mexican Street.
You can't beat that.
Yeah, I love getting a good mole there from Manolo's.
I mean, I'm blown away that, I go to Mexico every two years, I go down there for trips and just to visit, and I'm blown away that there's better Mexican food there than in Mexico.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's kind of sad to say. I mean, I don't go everywhere, but it's some really great dishes. I mean, Al's, I still like going down to Taylor Street.
Yeah.
My favorite is the only Al's.
Yeah.
Go to Al's on Taylor and then go right across the street to Mario's and get your ice.
Yeah.
That is it. That is the only way. That is the best street, if I were to say,
Yeah, I just wrote about for a best of issue, and Al's for me is that, a lot of people say Johnny's, whatever.
No.
I love Al's, number one on Taylor.
Number one. Spicy, messy, hot. It's like you get the fries. I mean, you can't ask for better.
It's dripping. You go through 500 napkins.
I've been going there since I was a kid, and that thing has never changed.
There was one other thing I wanted to ask you about. I had read about, I think that when you were at Mango, Julia Child was on a book tour, and you had done a 14-course meal for her that she took on her plane.
Julia came by the restaurant. It was at that time we had a lot of chefs on, Victron and Wolfgang Puck, and everybody would come by and eat dinner. Julia came by. It was a great honor in my life to meet Julia Child. She was going on a plane. She couldn't stay. We just had a conversation. We were talking about, because I was part of the Food and Wine. I was a chairman for the Food and Wine Board. in Chicago, and she was going on a plane trip, and I said, you can't leave without eating. And so we prepared a whole meal, sent it to the plane. She didn't know about it. We had it rushed out to the plane, taxicabbed it out. When she got on the plane, she had all the courses waiting for her.
Nice.
And I said, it's got to be better than plane food, so.
Nice. Did you hear, did you ever get
it? Yeah, she sent me a thank you letter.
That's awesome.
She really appreciated it. It kind of was astounding because it was like thinking, who'd do something like weird like that? Yeah. It was like, I got really good food on a plane. And it was kind of a nice touch. It was a unique time to be able to do something like that for her.
Were you nervous at all? Because you're cooking for
I always get nervous. Yeah. I certain people like that, you know. I mean, you know, Jean Mache, I mean, you have such revere and such respect for somebody because you know what it takes to do it. And you have such respect for them that it's not like it's not intimidation. It's more like just respect, and you want to be able to show them that, you know, you can do a good job. Yeah. That's all. And to this day, I've been written up enough times. I've had enough, and I've served enough people and had enough success with my restaurants and everything. And still to this day, I still get wowed when you see somebody that's, mm-hmm. you know, Wolfgang Puck or something like that who comes in. It's like, wow, Wolfgang's here, you know, let's do it again.
Yeah, I think of it as like, you know, you say food is love, and it's like, so if something isn't cooked right, then you feel like you're letting that person down in that relationship or whatever it is.
Kind of, and you want them to know that it's like, you know, I appreciate, and then usually a lot of times I'll go in and I don't try to do something that's out of my thing, out of my realm, or out of something. I try to do something that they understand and they can approach, something simple like a chicken and potatoes. And if it's a good chicken and mashed potato, they'll respect that more than anything because they know how hard it is to do something simple than to do something really hard.
Yeah. Well, thanks for doing this.
No problem. Yeah. Anytime.
I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Chicago Magazine Chefs on the Grill. If you have any feedback or suggestions, please drop me a line at mjnagran@hungrymag.com. And we'll see you next month. And in the meantime, stay hungry.
One more time.